Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Visa Burton, good evening. Welcome to our banquet here for the How Fast Words Conference. And I want to thank everybody for being here. What I've heard is that the conference is going along okay, and that's the case. And in large measure, it's because of your excellent presentations and discussion and conversations that are going on. But it's also Dan Wolman and our graduate students here who provided the class. And the food service workers here who will be taking care of us really well. So we want to thank the people who make these things happen. Let me just tell you what the order of service is here for the evening. I'm just going to ask Ann and Phoebe to just do a tune or two. And I don't know, Lisa, are you with us tonight or tomorrow or later on? We're going to have a party after this and we're going to have some more tunes. But, you know, what's life without music? So, Ann's going to do a little bit and then we have some awards to give out, and then Barbara Bowman is going to speak with us, and then we're going to be done. And then we'll have a party this evening, about 20 minutes or a half hour after this ends. We'll give people time to get over it again.
Very worried about the
in the Roth crowd where most of the people are staying in the dorms. And, you know, we'll just hang out and have a little bit of music and a little bit of conversation in an informal setting with some pretzels and pop and that kind of stuff. So, right here, Ann Feeney.
Well, I've been very impressed with the quality of the discourse and all the broad variety of subjects covered. But I've got to say, it's not much of a working class studies conference if we've gotten this far into it without a single polka. I would bet that there's a way to get this so where it would pick up the guitar. Is it on? Okay. Maybe it'll pick up from there. There we go, we have guitar. Okay, so this is a polka written by Joan Hill. That is not a pseudonym. She's a natural path in Seattle. And there's an awful lot of discussion about our ill-fated health group care campaign. So this is the most popular song from my Sing Out from Single Payer Road show of 2009.
We're nursing as fast as we can. We're running with bandages and bedpans. Our patients are sicker, the discharges are quicker. The reasons are slimmer why we can't afford more nurses who are nursing as fast as we can. More tough in nursing our plan. Our load isn't lighter, but the staffing is tighter, and we're nursing as fast as we can. Your anxiety is legitimate, I'll grant. You've been admitted for a liver transplant. You watch the nurses scurry, everybody's in a hurry. You've just begun to worry that we won't have time for you. Our time is limited, you must understand. We can't write by you within our budget. Your insurance plan's so tight, you can't even spend the night. We've got to send you home to do the best you can. Meanwhile, we're nursing as fast as we can. Our patients are quicker, the discharges are quicker, the reasons are quicker why we can't afford the more nurses who are nursing as fast as we can. More cuts in nursing our plans. Now our guests are obnoxious and the pain is preposterous, and we're nursing as fast as we can. I feel I must apologize to you for proceeding. You test your bed and ask the lying to the very busy, I was running in a tizzy. I over-optimistically thought I'd have time for you, but I had seven.
come to us much sicker than they used to. We know we need trained nurses, but the bosses watch their purses. When it's patient safety versus profit, we know what they do. Nurses who are registered must go. They hire nurses aides because they're cheaper. We know for patient safety, this can be a grave mistake. It's the chance they take to save a little dough. Meanwhile, we're nursing as fast as we can. We're running with bandages and bandages. But the debt is sinking, just like management spending. As our standards are sinking, while the risks we take are rising, like the salaries for those at the top. This misallocation must stop. Our superfluous superiors sit upon their posteriors in the comfy interiors of their offices and lounges while we're nursing as fast as we can. We must find a way to demand that patients won't be dying because some corporations trying to cut nursing as fast as they can. Single payer still the only real plan.
There's going to be plenty more of that when we get over to Hendricks later on. Right now, there are two sets of awards that we are doing here. This is a conference of the Center for Study of Working Class Life and also the Working Class Studies Association. So what I'd like to do is to introduce the president of the Working Class Studies Association, Michelle Bukarczyk, from Dalton College.
Well, just really briefly for those of you that aren't familiar with the book, although stateofthebook.org is the website that has excerpts and photos and documents from the struggle. I'm a labor educator. I'm a historian by academic training, but I'm a labor educator and activist by vocation. So I teach workers about steward training and collective bargaining and internal organizing and membership and labor law. And so one of the goals in writing the book was to give a vehicle for workers and unionists. People ask me, what do you do? Because labor education is not something people really understand. I tell them, I help workers build power to work. That's what I do. And that was part of our goal with this book, because this was one of the most innovative, dynamic militant struggles in the last 30 years. We were so thrilled to be 3 hours north of Decatur and come across these workers who transformed an apathetic, uninvolved local, divided by race and gender, into a local with 1,000 people a week coming to meetings, where the members really took control. They sent scores of scared, unskilled people across the country telling their stories, called road warriors, building support, built 60 solidarity committees. I headed the one in Chicago, and I were very active. So we wrote a book as kind of a manual of resistance about work to rule, about inside campaigns, how to transform an apathetic local, nonviolent civil disobedience, corporate campaigns, everything they did. And the second goal was to really tell their story. And that's the history I love the best, the history that tells workers' stories, to tell the story through their voices. I think workers in struggle are the best teachers. They've inspired me, and I hope through their book we inspire others. And to tell you the truth, they continue to be teachers in Illinois. Besides teaching trade unionists, we have an online program of labor studies. We have 1,000 students a semester learning about workers and unions. They come in apathetic, they come out in favor of workers' rights and unions. So I feel good about that. And we, in our introduction to labor studies, we recently switched over from Peter Ratcliffe's book on the Hormel struggle to the Staley struggle, since it's 45 minutes from Decatur. And every semester we bring workers over. Now they lost their struggle. This is like dozens and dozens of Norma Rae's who were lost to the labor movement. Brilliant organizers who were lost to the labor movement. Betrayed by labor officials and defeated by corporate America. They come every spring and fall and speak to my students. We had 250 students come 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And 7 or 8 workers spoke to them, and they just have such an impact. They continue to be teachers. There's no greater education than the workers in struggle telling their stories. It gives me great hope. Continues to give me great hope. Thank you very much for this great award. Very honored.
I am also very honored to be a recipient of this award. C.J. Hawking, and I'm a United Methodist pastor. And I also run an interfaith workers' rights group in Chicago called Arise Chicago. And I cut my teeth on this daily struggle. Didn't know much about labor, but these workers taught me so very much. I'd like to dedicate the award to two people, both in Decatur, both locked out daily workers. And the first is Jeanette Hawkins. She's an African-American woman who persevered in spite of insurmountable racism and sexism in the local union. But she committed herself to transform the union and transform her community. And also to Gary Lamb. Gary is a white worker who, while working in the plant for 26 years, rarely connected with any of his African-American peers. And through this struggle, Gary opened himself up to the point that as a road warrior, Gary Lamb once found himself in Harlem with another worker. They had been speaking all day to labor groups throughout New York City, and they were staying with some folks that they had never met before in Harlem. They got out of the subway stop, each worker having $3,000 in donations in their pocket. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't even have an address, but they just knew that there was something special on the outside of the building. They were scared, and when they walked up to a group of African Americans who then gave them directions, the black gentleman ended the conversation with saying, "It's all right, brother, we're all in this together." And by Gary opening himself up, he not only transformed himself, but he also helped to transform the union. So to Jeanette and Gary, who I believe point the way forward for the labor movement and for all working class people, and for everyone who cares about changing their community and our world, one person at a time. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next award is the Tilly Olson Prize for the Best Creative Work. And this goes to Jennifer Ray Vernon for a book of poetry, Rock Candy, published by West End Press. I'm very pleased to present our next award, the Studs Terkel Media Award for Media and Journalism, for the DVD, Why Are We in Afghanistan? Written by Michael Zweig, illustrated by Mike Konopaki, produced and edited by Trish Dalton and Michael Zweig. Will they please talk to us?
DVD, Why Are We in Afghanistan, right here, is available to you at the Center for Study of Working Class Life shop here, and also online, Why Are We in Afghanistan. Just to say, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq must be the center of our attention if we're going to talk about what's going on in the public sector. Because these people are telling us there is no money. These people are telling us we can't afford a jobs program. President Obama actually said at the jobs summit last December, "I want your ideas, we need your ideas, but don't forget, we don't have any money." We spent $100 billion this year in Afghanistan. The labor movement has taken on the war in Iraq. We built U.S. labor against the war. My union, United University of President, and PSC, and so many other unions built that organization around Iraq, and now we're building it around Afghanistan. We need educational materials. We need materials that can connect with people and help them to build an anti-war movement and a labor movement, and bring the labor movement into the peace movement. And that's what this is about. And when I was trying to put it together, I thought, this thing, if it's just words, how far is that going to go? This needs art. This needs visual. This needs to be able to touch people. I can't do that. So I went to people who can. To Mike Konopaki, who's one of the great labor illustrators and cartoonists, and to Trish Dalton, who's one of the finest editors. I want to thank them both and bring them up here to say a word or two themselves.
Thank you, Mike. Really, this is just
Mike's story, and I really just want to say thank you for being able to come on to it, because I think it's obviously, from the response we've gotten, it's changed a lot of people's view and really put the issue that I also feel very passionate about and into a better perspective for everybody who's seen it, and allows the historical perspective and the perspective of what's going on now in this country, brings it all together. Because it's your story and you knew how to tell them. So I'm glad that it's out there, and I do encourage everyone to see it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really do want to thank Mike and Trisha for this, because I'm the guy that has to put the pictures to the words, but when you have a really great editor and a really great writer, that's what makes this stuff work. The most important thing about the labor movement when we fight against these kind of wars is that the people that are fighting these wars are workers. You know, one of the greatest labor cartoonists in the country was Bill Walden, who drew about the workers that fought the war in World War II. And it's working people and farmers that are dying in Afghanistan at the end of these missiles from these drones. And so it's really working people that are at the end of this thing. You know, they're the ones that are suffering from it. They're the ones that are being killed. And, you know, so it's important for us in the labor movement to honor these folks, but also to say we have to put an end to this kind of madness, because, you know, the one thing that you can always predict is empires will fall, because every empire has. So our empire is going to fall unless we decide not to be an empire. Thanks.
Switching hats, as the organizer of this conference and the chair of the program committee, we have in our conferences historically, independent of the Working Class Studies Association, every 2 years since 2004, given what we call the award for lifetime contributions to social justice for working people. And here's what you have to do to get one of these awards. You have to be at least 75 years old. The lifetime contributions, you know, we're not talking about Beyonce. We want people who have had a lifetime of contributions. So 75 years or more. And they have to still be active. And they have to have made really serious contributions to social justice for working people. So this year, as we considered the field, we thought two people we wanted to recognize of many possibilities. One is the photographer Milton Rabovin, and the other is Francis Fox Piven. So talk a little bit about them to introduce and to present this award for Milton Rabovin. I want to ask Janet and Andy to come up and make this presentation, which I'm clattering around down here to find the plaques. Here it is.
Good evening, everyone. I want to remind you there's a card on your table regarding Milton Rabovin, What's Ahead in Chicago, regarding his work. How many of you know Milton Rabovin's photography? I think what he has accomplished so much in his 100 years plus, one thing that strikes me as extremely important is answering the question, how do you represent working class people without shaming them? And you do that, it seems to me, by not seeing them as objects, by developing relationships with them over a span of many years. And Milton Rabovin did that in Buffalo for many, many years. and some of you may know his book, Portraits in Steel, and his work where he revisited the same neighborhood in triptychs, and that later quartets. There's a wonderful biography about him, and there's a film called, more than one film, but one particularly interesting is The Rich Have Their Own Photographers. And that's Saul Goldman. And so it's my pleasure to welcome Paula Rogovin, who has agreed to accept the award for her father, Milton.
On behalf of our family, my dad's not traveling too far anymore. If you drive down Elmwood Avenue in Buffalo on a Saturday afternoon, you'll see our father, Milton, making peace signs, waving to all the passersby. They have a weekly anti-war vigil. He still goes to that. He turned 100 on December 30th. And he still really loves to be at that vigil. I asked him on the way here, I said, Dad, what do you want me to tell them when I speak tonight? And, you know, his greatest wish is that his photographs will be used by you and by your students and by people you work with, that those photographs will be used and out there. They're very accessible. They're on the internet if you look, you know, for his name. And they're also in books and in the movie. But he also said he wants you to sing. He wants to sing. So how about one of his songs? Sometimes my first graders, we pick up the cell phone in New York and we call him and we sing with him. Maybe you'll sing this just one verse. Last night I had the strangest dream I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. And there's more to that song, you know it. There are a lot of series. I'll tell you very, very briefly about a few of them. Of course, he always said the rich had their own photographers, and he wanted to portray the dignity of working people. His first series was Black Storefront Churches in Buffalo, and he published that in Aperture with an essay by W.E.B. Du Bois, who encouraged him to do that series. He later worked in the steel mills and foundries of Buffalo and Lackawanna, New York. He took photos in the factories, and then he went to the workers' homes. And then when the steel mills closed, and many of the foundries closed, he went back and photographed the same people. And you'll see some of the interviews of the workers in those photographs. Michael Frisch, oral historian, some of you probably know, many of you probably know, interviewed a whole number of the workers, and those interviews are in Portraits in Steel. My dad really wants you to see those photographs and use those photographs in your work. He did a series in 10 coal mining countries around the world, in China, in Cuba, Spain, Scotland, in Appalachia, in the USA, and more. He went to the Lower West Side of Buffalo over 30 years and photographed the same people over and over again. That was published with some stories, some interviews by David Isay from StoryCorps. He worked with Pablo Neruda and published some photographs that he did there with Pablo Neruda. He published those. My dad never cared about fame or fortune, and social documentary photographers don't get rich. All he wanted to do, and my mom, who was kind of his partner in reaching out to people, all they want is for you to use the photographs, for people to see them, for students to use them, and to inspire people to
document the lives of poor and working people. I will just quickly share one poem. He started writing poetry. It's never too late. He started writing poetry at age 87. My mom gave him a clipboard and his photographs, and they had this little curvy chair in the living room, and she said, write. And the reason he wrote the poems is because he felt like, you know, when you look at a photograph, you interpret it your way. But he had so much more he wanted to say. He wanted to make sure that we knew that the person looked so sad because they got a pink slip when the lines were closed or when the steel mills were closed. He wanted us to know more of the background of the people in the photograph. So this is one of my favorites. It's called Theme Boy. His land is dying. You can see it in his eyes. The mines are closing. This too in his eyes. Look into his eyes. They will tell you lots. Lots more of mountaintops stripped and gouged, of streams polluted, of fish destroyed. Remember, America, this should be, this must be, the land of opportunity and equality for all, including this boy.
Down here. So on behalf of Francis, we have Phil Tabb here to receive this. And I just want to point out that on the tables here and the chairs is a photocopy of an article that Bill had in Clarion, which is a newspaper of the Perpetual Staff Congress, responding to attacks on Francis. And so that's part of what you need to know. But I just want to call on Bill to accept this award and say a word. We decided to give this award before Glenn Beck went out after, but we're especially glad that we made the decision that we made under these circumstances.
Thank you, Michael. I've taught jointly, and I'm on a board, and we do other things together. And so Michael asked me if I would accept this for Francis. How many people have ever heard Francis speak? Okay, then I don't have to say anything to you people. That Francis is the kind of person I think many of us would like to be. That as academics, many of us are academics, and we do our writing, Francis has a consistent life in that she both writes about the political work she does and the political, and in the writing itself, of course, is political. It conveys important things that we need to know. But when she writes about voter registration, it's because she has spent years and years getting the voter-voter law passed. Glenn Beck shows this clip of Clinton signing it. Francis is behind her, and the camera goes to focus on Francis. Because Glenn Beck has a complicated theory of how the country got into such a mess and how this man got elected president. And it begins with Woodrow Wilson and progressivism. Progressive is a code word for socialism. And the key turning point in the history of America gone bad is the Cloward-Piven thesis. And if you put the Cloward-Piven thesis in a search engine, the last time I did it, I don't know, 20,000 hits or something, they are to blame for the economic collapse because, according to Beck, the theory is You put the whole country on welfare, and of course it bankrupts the country, and that's why we have the crisis. Woodrow Wilson also created the Federal Reserve, which he doesn't blame Francis for, but Obama is all Francis is doing. And Francis is rather proud of this. But I want to tell you something else, which I don't think is such a wonderful thing. And she gets interviewed all the time. You know, people, TV crews come from around the world to interview her. And students, just huge numbers, feel she's approachable, because of course she is. And sometimes they come and they take the interviews, and she signs the books and all that. And a little while ago, this fellow from Michigan said he was a student in Michigan, and could he videotape the interview? And she didn't think anything of this. She does this all the time. It turned out he's a Republican Party operative. And the videotape was to get her to say things that would confirm this conspiracy theory and show, you know, because the article was in 1966, and if anyone's read it, it has nothing to do with these fantasies. The article was about if people on welfare demanded their rights and they overwhelmed the system, we would have to move to a sensible kind of system, you know, the way the Europeans do with family assistance plan, the kind that Nixon and Moynihan were considering doing, you know, very radical. Richard Nixon, you may know him, he's a college. But they made it into this big mess. Anyway, this guy came and interviewed her, and 12 minutes of this is on a thing that's going around the internet. And the major accusation is what Francis is saying, what the banks did to the country and what it did to working people. And this video gets a great response because all these right-wingers, she's right, you know. And so they chose what they thought was the most damaging part, and actually now she gets fan mail from these right-wing types. Which is a tribute, I think, to just a wonderful human being. The last thing I'll tell you is her current book is on the working class. And it's an effort to explain class and workers. And in the situation at the moment, she's begun it. It won't be out for a while. But I think maybe another award will be in order when it comes out. Thank you very much.
Out that upstairs in the bookstore on the third floor, the on-site bookstore, there are the books of Milton Rogoli that are up there. So you can see them. And we also have some posters, signed and dated posters from Milton in the center store right here in the gallery. One of the things that we talk about here in class terms, class dynamics of the society, so many of us are in higher education. So many of us are in public higher education. And we are facing very intense problems and very intense transformations that are going on. And class has something to do with that. And we asked Barbara Bowman, who was the president of PSC CUNY, one of the great labor leaders in New York and around the country who thinks about these questions and has something to say, come here and help us understand in a way that comes out of experience but also deep thought what is going on and how do we understand the transformation that's underway under our very feet in the context of the class dynamics of the society. Barbara.
To be here with scholars of working class life and people who know the history, hear the stories, with educators, labor educators, with some of my own colleagues from City University of New York, also from our national union, the AFT, our state affiliate, NYSED, our brothers and sisters here at the SUNY union here, United University Professions. So I feel very lucky to be in the company of people who do this work and privileged to speak. And I don't know if we really had a chance as a group here at the conference to express together our thanks to Mike Zweig. So I thought maybe we could start there. I know we've all been wanting to say that through the various days, but he is an engine behind this event, and we're all indebted to him. What's especially important, I think, to me about being in a room full of people who do this, who study class and working class as part of, for many of you anyway, many of you are educators in the labor field, but many of you are scholars in this area. And it's especially important for me to hear that because I think your work, in part, is making the working class visible. And I think that at this moment, that has a particular valence because at the current moment, especially since the 2008 recession, but also going way back even to Proposition 13 in California in the 70s, but what we see sharply now is that the working class, when it is visible, seems to me is visible either as victims to be lamented or else as scapegoats to be blamed for the current economic crisis. And what feels especially important to me about the work a lot of you do is that you place working class people in a different light and show us, we just heard that about the photographs, literally in a different light. And that at this moment seems an intensely political act, a progressive political act, when we're seeing workers so often lamented if they're even thought of in terms of people who are unemployed or else people who are the casualties, the literal casualties of working class accidents that happen to workers, and or else we are presented as the cause of these crises. And those two poles made me think about something James Baldwin said in an interview once. People can cry easier than they can change. People can cry easier than they can change. And I thought about that when we saw the representation of workers in Haiti, when we even heard about the 11 workers killed on the oil rig. People can cry easier than they can change. And that's part of what I want to try to think about tonight when I think about working people and the academy. My question tonight really is whether we can see in this political moment, the current historical present as we call it, whether we can see working class people and workers not just as victims or let's say the cause of the current evil or those who are blamed for that, but whether we can see workers as a source of resistance and a source of transformation. And those are two areas where I think in the current deep, deep recession, we have yet to see a working class culture emerge, and in this country, I would say, yet to see a broad mass working class resistance. So part of my question, I want to reflect on the academy, as Mike said, but also to think about where the resistance is and what the relation is between that resistance and a working class culture. And I hope that some of you in the room, maybe we can talk afterwards about the relation between resistance and culture. And I say that very cautiously, thinking only of the United States, because I know there are people in this room who are not from the United States and who study other places, and we have seen mass working class resistance in other places. We've seen it in Greece. We've seen it in Latin America. We've seen it since this. We've seen it in Spain. And probably people in this room could talk about other instances of that. Certainly, it would be exciting, I think, for all of us to think about what the conditions are that led to mass resistance on the streets in Greece, in France, in other places, and have not yet produced that here. So one of the questions for me that is constant, obviously it has to be there for anybody who is working in the labor movement, is where is that resistance and how can this moment of deep attack on working people, of deep economic recession, which is still felt by working people, whether it's officially over or not. We all know that working people, and especially the public sector, still feels that perhaps even more than 2008, 2009. How can this be a moment of rebuilding? I choose the metaphor rebuilding because we're at a public state university. At this moment, the State University and the City University of New York are under intense attack. As any of us in this room who work there know, in fact, when I walked in, Artie, the labor leader here, said to me, well, enjoy the space while the lights are still on. And there's something true about that. We are under intense attack every day. We hear about cuts to the workers, more cuts to the lights, more cuts to the library, the labs, everything. In the Depression, in the 1930s, three new colleges were built at the City University of New York. Three public colleges were built during the Depression, and tuition stayed free. The State University was not yet established, but the City University in New York City goes back to 1847, and tuition was free from 1847 on until the 1970s, when structural adjustment, i.e. the fiscal crisis in New York City, when that structural adjustment, which is now the mode of operation of the World Bank, when that began in New York City and the crunch was on City University. But I think it's important for us to know that in a deeper economic trough, the response of New York City was to invest in public higher education, not to disinvest. What makes it so different now? Why is it so different? Why can't this be a moment of rebuilding? And that's really my question. Why can't this be a moment of rebuilding? How do we make this a moment where, you know, when we look back now, we think about the 30s, you think about working class culture. You think about all that rich culture. Where are the songs now about the unemployed when we have 46% unemployment of African American men in New York City? That's a depression level. That's not a recession level. That's a depression level unemployment. Where is the culture that supports that and needs that? And I really don't have the answer to that, but I think it's something for all of us, and I'm sure lots of you are thinking about it and writing about it and working through it. If we start right here, where we are in the State University, probably some of you, so to contrast that with the moment in the 1930s when the response was to build new colleges, and in fact, FDR, Roosevelt, whenever he saw the mayor of New York City, LaGuardia, Fiorello LaGuardia, coming to him, he said he was going to start avoiding LaGuardia because every time LaGuardia appeared to him, it meant a new college. And if only that were true, when we have a mayor instead who's dismantling colleges. To take one very sharp instance here, it could have happened that instead of being sitting in this room and having people working and graciously serving meals and washing dishes and turning on the lights and all of us being paid for faculty at the State University, we could have all been shut down today because our governor wanted to shut down one-fifth of the time at the State University, starting a couple of weeks ago, and the City University, and put us all on a 20% pay cut, otherwise known as a furlough. We felt that attack right on us, for all of us at the State and City University, and we fought back. The first day it was announced that we would be included, our union went right out on the street, and we had about 3 hours to call a demonstration, and we were out on the street in front of the governor's office. Then we joined together with our brothers and sisters at SUNY right here and filed a series of legal actions with two other unions in the state, all of us doing more or less the same thing, and we got a temporary restraining order stopping the governor from doing that and got a second legal victory, last week. So we've been fighting in the courts and on the streets. I think this fight is not over. But right here at State University, we faced a situation where we could have been closed for a day each week. And I think that's just the beginning, actually, of, well, maybe we'll be lucky, but that is the beginning of attacks that we are feeling in New York State, and the governor will be back to call for more. That's only one part of a pattern of attacking public sector workers that I'm sure you are all familiar with. We're seeing it right across the country. And I really feel that, and I think Mike Zweig mentioned this earlier, the public sector is being dismantled before our eyes. Just to take a look at since 2008, 30 states have cut funding for health care. 25 states have cut funding for services to the elderly. 30 states have cut funding for K-12 education. And 41 states have cut funding for public higher education. The most popular thing to cut is public higher education. Very interesting at a time when working people are increasingly turning to public higher education to help them weather this crisis and come out of it with new skills. It's just the moment when cuts are being applied. The other moment when cuts began in serious earnest was when the population in public higher education changed, when it shifted from being largely the middle class, largely white people, to being much broader, more people of color, more working class people. That's when the series of cuts began that we saw right after the baby boom. And also in 23 states, governors or state legislatures have imposed these pay cuts, which disguise themselves under the lovely sounding word, furlough, which sort of sounds like, oh, it's a vacation or something. It's not. A furlough is a pay cut. A furlough is a pay cut. 23 states have imposed that. We are seeing everywhere, I'm sure everybody in this room could name the way that the recession is being used to dismantle a public sphere that people literally gave their lives for, that took years to build up. Beneath that is, I feel, a tendency and an acceptance that the economic recession is a force of nature, that it wasn't created by anybody. It doesn't come out of a capitalist structure. It doesn't only come out of a lack of regulation. It comes out of the whole capital structure that we have, the recession. But instead, the way it's presented to all of us who suffer from it is that it's natural. It just happened. It's inevitable. As Mike Zweig said earlier, we hear from the highest levels to the lowest, well, there's no money. There's just no money. We heard that exactly about the plan to do pay cuts at SUNY and CUNY State University, the whole and across the state, all public workers in New York. The furlough, the 20% pay cut, was designed to produce $250 million. And the governor said, this is what we need to close the state budget. You workers, you have to sacrifice. Everybody else has sacrificed. You have to sacrifice. You've got to do your furloughs, creating $250 million. You know what the state budget deficit is? $9 billion. $250 million is nothing. It had nothing to do with closing the deficit. The only way to close the deficit in the state, and also more broadly, is to change the revenue system, restore the progressive taxation that was taken away. And instead of that solution, what we hear is the economic crisis is naturalized, it's inevitable that there's no money, and the only sector that is still greedily having the nerve to have a pension, to have a health plan, to have a decent pay is the public sector, so the public sector must now be targeted. We know that scenario. Naomi Klein, of course, memorably wrote about it under her in her book on the shock doctrine. And I think we're feeling that now. We're living under that at this moment. We even see in the recent Newsweek article that really targeted teachers and teachers' unions, that article lamented that there were not more Hurricane Katrinas to wipe out the school systems in other cities so they could start anew. And that to me seems like the nadir of the application of that shock doctrine. If you can't get a natural disaster, that of course never is natural, like the earthquake in Haiti or Hurricane Katrina, those are not natural. Those have their consequences are completely humanly determined. But if you can't create an event in nature, then there's a recession which can be presented as inevitable, and we can all be forced to dismantle and undo the public sector, which is of course part of what's behind this. I think that higher education, public higher education, performs a very useful function in thinking about this, because in public higher education, we've been under that shock doctrine for 30 years in slow motion. Higher education has been privatized. I'm speaking here about the public sector, which is the vast majority, 85% of college students in this country are in the public sector. We have been privatized in slow motion over 30 years. What's happening to the public sector broadly has been happening in higher education, where many of us are located, for quite a long time. It's been less visible to us because it's been incremental. But over those 30 years, the conditions of employment have been so changed that a profession that once provided real support for students and also a living wage for the people who taught there is now one of the most dysfunctional labor systems in the country. We have fewer than a third of our teaching instructors in the whole of higher education nationally who have secure jobs, either tenure track or tenure jobs full time. The rest of the entire universe of instruction in public higher education is in some kind of insecure job. That is not true in any of the professions, and it's even not true in a lot of the private sector jobs. Yes, there's been a move toward contingency nationally across the labor spectrum in the United States, but the move toward contingency nationally has ended us with about 30% contingent jobs nationally, or contingent or part-time, 60% or more in higher education. So we're at twice the rate of contingency and part-timization as the rest of the economy in this country. So I think higher education, even though we're a relatively privileged sector of education, forms a good model for looking at what happens when you pull the money out of the sphere and you begin to dismantle the working conditions. That's what has happened to us. And just to finish, I'd like to talk, because I hope we have a little time for conversation, but I'd like to talk about thinking about higher education and other sectors. Where then do we look for resistance at this moment? If we're seeing the public sector being dismantled, health care in many cases, we'll see what happens next in that, but education, K-12 education, higher education, services for the elderly, jobs for youth in the summer, you name it. Where are we seeing resistance? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. But one thing that strikes me is the multiplicity of small places that I think you can find resistance. And as a union leader, I'm thinking about how organized labor can be part of that. Is organized labor at this point in this country positioned to lead resistance to the dismantling of the public sector, the attacks on working people, or are we as organized labor positioned to contain that resistance? And I think that's still a question. It's a question for me, even as a leader of my own union. Am I in that position of sparking that resistance or holding it back, containing it? We've seen, I can think of some examples of resistance by workers. There was a strike in the Bronx in New York City that several of us in this room came and gave support to at the Stella Doro cookie factory. And their slogan was, no contract, no cookies. They were on strike for 11 months. They were a noticeably racially diverse group of workers. The men were coming out all right in the contract, the jobs that most of the men did, but they went on strike because the jobs that most of the women did in the factory were going to be deeply undermined. They stayed on strike for more than 11 months, and not one person crossed the picket line in 11 months. They won a legal victory, but their union in the end did not support them doing a more militant struggle. They looked at the Republic Doors and Windows struggle, where there was the factory takeover. They looked hard at that struggle. They didn't do that on the last day. There was a feeling of, can we do it? They didn't do that. They have continued to meet, and that now it's like 6 months that the strike is over. They continue to meet in study groups together, the workers from that plant, and some of them were funded by a group of unions, including ours, to go to Haiti and do education and rebuilding in Haiti. So there's a struggle that has proliferated a little bit. Another one that strikes me is children in a library in Bloomington, Indiana. When the library hours were cut, the children who went to that library wrote a play called The Case of the Missing Librarian. And in that play, it was about children who literally lost their voices, lost the ability to speak, because they no longer had a librarian to read to them. And I think that's a fantastic play because it's about children not having their voices. They recognized what was at stake in that.
We can see resistance in different places, and we can see how, you know, I would say as a union leader, one of the things that we have tried to do is fight our own battles strongly and fight them as workers, because I think too many of us in the public sector feel that the only way we can make a fight in the public, since they're so ready to scapegoat us and demonize us as the problem, we have to hide behind the people we serve. And I noticed that tendency. Yes, of course we're proud because we serve students. Yes, teachers are proud because it's about the children. Nurses are proud because it's about the patients. But I feel somewhat that we are reluctant to take that step and say that we need this because we are workers. We're entitled to it, not just for the people we serve. I mean, absolutely, it's about them. But it bothers me that there's such reluctance, even in workers, let's say, holding pickets, to say that this is about our jobs, too. It always has to be about somebody else. I think that if we actually stood up for our jobs, people would be proud. They would be proud. They wouldn't say, oh, you greedy professors. They would, yes, we have to say we're fighting for the students as we are, and that's what motivates us. But I think people would be proud to see us standing up for our own conditions of work. I think that's why our members were so excited when we stood up against the 20% pay cut, otherwise known as furloughs. So when we think about how we might develop resistance and where it can come from, in this moment, I really hesitate to present any answers, but I think one way for us, and here I speak as an academic, is to start with our own shattered and disgraceful workplace. I think it's a disgraceful workplace because of the two-tier labor system, because of the... Oh, it is. I mean, we're all there. But I say that, don't clap too much, because I haven't solved it in our own union. I mean, it's a hard thing to solve. And I think we need to start there if we're in academia, but not stop there. And one thing we have tried to do in our union is build some bridges. So when the maintenance workers at a big apartment complex in New York City, Co-op City, were locked out 2 days ago, we went into our database and found that through our zip code that we had 70 members who live in that apartment complex, believe it or not, it's New York City. So we, in a couple of hours, we sent them out a message and asked them to go to support the strike at their apartment complex. And they did, and they read our message out on their picket line. That's a little bit of a connection. It's not going to win that strike. It's not going to win it. But I think, for me, what gives a little bit of hope is focusing on our own house and standing up for that bravely and unapologetically, that we deserve to have decent working conditions, whatever we do, and trying to make a link with workers who more obviously have a physical oppression or more sharply economic oppression in their own jobs. So, just to end, I think what I would pose and really try to think about is a combination of very slow, deliberate, one-on-one, trying to rebuild connections among our own, let's say, faculty and staff as working people. That is hard. We've done a project at CUNY on trying to work about on the two-tier labor system. This year, we did 733 conversations with individual members. We assessed each one about where they were on that issue, and we're going to do more next year. That's what I mean by slow, patient building. And I guess my thought would be to combine that slow, patient rebuilding of a network, refinding of a culture and connection among ourselves as working people. I think we need to refine that connection when the idea of being a worker has been so denigrated and we feel almost embarrassed to stand up as workers. We have to find and recreate that culture. And at the same time, I would suggest that we combine the slow, patient rebuilding, refinding with a very impatient, audacious view and hope for what we can achieve, a vision. I think this is, in fact, the moment to sharpen our demands, because that's how we're going to develop a strong culture. People are going to feel motivated to be with us if we have broad, ambitious demands, even in this moment. And it seems to me in academia, this might be, oddly enough, the moment when we have the biggest chance of taking on the labor ill in our own working system, in our own workplace, by combining the biggest demand we have for transformation with the most patient, careful work we can do to build those two things together. So I submit that as a possibility for finding resistance, because if we don't find, and we make, not just find, it's not sitting there, I don't think. The resistance that could be to this economic moment is not just sitting there waiting for us to pick it up. I think we have to make it, but not just start anew, but remake it from what all of us know in this room. And that's why I think what we have in this room is so valuable, and you mustn't just hug it to yourself. You must share it with all of us who need what you have, because I think that's what we have to do in this moment. We do not want people standing up at a working class studies conference 40, 50 years from now and looking at this economic recession and saying, why was there no resistance? So let us try to create that together. Thank you very much. Mike has no time for questions, so have a good party. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Barbara. Obviously, this is so rich. There's so much that we could go on about and talk about, which is why we have another day for the conference and a lifetime to do our work and to come back and to come back and to come back richer and richer with experience and insight. Let me say that we have in the House tonight Maria Maso, who's the president of New Faculty Majority. Yeah, Maria, people. Maria is out from Akron, Ohio, is the president of the New Faculty Majority. It's a new organization, relatively new, of contingent academic labor. And Maria is here as part of the conference to work with particularly the contingent academic labor who's here and the graduate students who are looking forward to maybe a life of contingent academic labor. You all need to think about what's going on and talk to this woman and talk to other people who are here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in this room to figure out how concretely to take on this question of contingent academic labor in the academic world, not just where there are unions, but wherever there are contingent academic workers. Because it's not just through unions that the labor movement is built. It's not just through union organizing and collective bargaining that workers make progress. So Maria is somebody who's putting this together on a national scale, is going to be in this room during breakfast tomorrow, and we'll put a couple tables together in the back there, and Maria will be there to talk with people and to lead a discussion and to work with people who are interested in organizing on this so that we can make some progress. Tomorrow morning at breakfast at 8 o'clock, again in this room, at 9 o'clock, also in this room, is our plenary session on charter schools. Very important stuff. We were just talking about privatization and how does that work. We have people here from the American Federation of Teachers. We have people here from schools, the School of Chicago, and other people who are really thinking about this, working on it, organizing. And it's going to be a very important and interesting session. Of course, we have a whole day of program tomorrow as well. Let me also point out that in your registration packet, there is a sheet for conference evaluation. We take that seriously. A lot of the features that you see in this conference that I've heard people say they like is part of what we've gotten from past feedback and past evaluation forms. So please do fill those out before you leave the conference and leave them at the front desk at the registration table. Or if you forget to do that, you'll see there's an address where you can mail it in. And please do that. Tonight, we are going to adjourn from here, and at about 10 o'clock, just give people time to chill a little bit and get back to the dorms in Hendricks, which is one of the dorms that's part of the Ross Quad over there. In the lobby, as you just go in the front of that Hendricks,
there's going to be a little bit of a party. We have some refreshments there, we could say, and we'll have a little bit more music, and we'll hang and just continue into the evening in the general area of the dormitories. And for people who are in the hotel, there are shuttles going back, but I'm sure that there are going to be people at that party with cars who can go back, so don't worry about the shuttle vans. Come on down and help us have a good time. So again, I want to thank Barbara, and I want to thank the people who have come here tonight to make this the event that it is. Have a good evening. We'll see you here again tomorrow.